Okay, so Jonathan, we want you to speak to us as a psychotherapist. We want you to reflect to us who we are. Let us find ourselves through your words to us. Because we know you to be a man of empathy, the most enormous compassion, of terrific humour, a rapier-sharp intellect. We now know you to be a union organiser, and you too, for a gold card, can have a gold coin, can have a red card, and you'll hear more about that later. We're all part of the union. We also know you, Jonathan, to be a poet of infinite sensitivity, and we hear that particularly whenever we're with you in the Porinui. We've heard that now more than once, and each time I'm moved to tears by the depth of your understanding of what it means to be standing biculturally in Aotearoa. And as soon as you speak, we can hear that you weren't born in Aotearoa. You've become. And we know that you've partly been able to become because of the great privilege that you have in being in relationship with Margaret. And we know Margaret to be an absolutely exquisite tutor. And we all benefit from Margaret's tuition. And we know that you have most of all. And aren't you so lucky? You are so blessed. It is such a privilege. So, Jonathan, we look forward to you helping us to find our way. And we know that we will be enriched by the journey. So welcome to speak to us. Okay.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ngā mihi nui kia koutou. Nau mai, hare mai ki ngā korero, ki ngā whakaaro. Tēnā koe ngā huia. Tēnā koe Michael. You are both significant psychotherapeutic presences. To have a book signed by Michael, or to have a story told to you by Ngahuia, is to have a therapeutic experience. Tēnā koe, Susan Burke, and the organizing committee, Te Tau Ihu o Te Waka Maui. It is very intimidating to stand here before my peers. I rather wish I was a very long way away addressing a conference of complete strangers. I've always had far too much to say, and in that regard, I won't disappoint you. But I did find preparing for this talk to be very challenging. Burke said, big picture. Well, I can do big picture. Burke said, nothing too controversial. Well, what does that leave?
Dad, you're finished.
Nana, would you like another cup of tea? Anyway, I've done my best. Big picture, not too controversial. I reckon I've been wildly half successful. One out of two. Friends, colleagues, distinguished guests, welcome. We meet together today to explore our conference theme, In the Unknown, at the time of the Great Turning. The recognition that our market-driven industrial civilization is unsustainable, that it cannot and will not be sustained, This is the civilizational moment when it dawns on us that we've traveled too far from our home and can no longer afford to venture bravely outward, but must instead turn and chart a course for home. To recall a familiar phrase from younger days, this is the dawning of the age of Aquarius. The light of the world dawns in us as the light of understanding. The deep wisdom of Te Ao Māori and quantum physics informs us that separation is an illusion. The cosmic world, the natural world, and the human world are one. Everything we're now discovering in modern science supports the ancient indigenous wisdom of holism and holistic thinking. There is for us only one world, one creation, one reality. It is mind and matter, soul and sense, psychic process, and objective fact. All things and all processes are interconnected, part of the whole. As we now know, everything is made up of the same stuff. Our bodies are quite literally made out of stardust. But to live in the shining light of this wisdom, we must first survive the darkness, the convulsive death throes of the Piscean era, as it plays itself out in more and more violent extremes. To survive ourselves, we'll need to seek the deepest taproots of our cultural heritage, species-wide. In order to re-educate ourselves and transform our world, and there is very little time in which to accomplish this task. To survive ourselves, we will have to reorganize our societies, dismantle our domination structures, interrupt our destructive habits, and alter our way of life. This has become our collective species survival imperative. Now we've recognized our absolute dependence upon the integrity of the biosphere and the geosphere, which are not separate from our bodies, which are not separate from our minds, which are not separate from ourselves. Now we know our lives and the lives of our children depend on our ability to dream reality. The unity of the Earth community, and the kinship of humankind with all other creatures with whom we share the planet. The birth of a star, the birth of a flower, the birth of a child are all part of one unfolding we know directly from our life experience. We call it creation, and it is everywhere. The dark matter that astrophysicists now believe makes up most of the universe we know in psychotherapy is the unconscious. These are not metaphors, analogies constructed in order to make tender-hearted and soft-minded connections between separate, unrelated processes. These are approximations that attempt to approach and draw near to an objective reality that is mysteriously isomorphic and holographic, in which each part actually does reflect the whole. When the theme of this conference was first mooted, Burke suggested we should, like the mariners of old, on the great seafaring voyages of discovery, triangulate our position. The desire for three speakers and three points of view today has been in the service of that agenda. Likewise, I will attempt to triangulate our position along three sight lines. These are sentient universe, eco-catastrophe, and the arc of psychotherapy. In describing these three, I'm hoping to address the very immediate and pragmatic task of remaking our social world with the help of psychotherapy. So I'm hoping to offer you three epiphanies found in the realm of the unknown while trying to find my way home. I do love the sound of the word epiphany. It promises a lot. When I was little, I was told a story about a man named Saul who got totally bushwhacked by an epiphany on the road to Damascus. I don't know if he ever made it to Damascus, but he became St. Paul, famous apostle of the New Testament. So Epiphany 1, sentient universe, or the good news from the cosmos. I'll begin with a poem called Small Matter. Do you ever dream of the old days? Remember the first atomic dance? All the protons clustering at the center, juvenile and nervous, hoping to appear dashing against a black background. And those pretty electrons doing pirouettes at the periphery, drunk on their own motion, photons cascading off their skirts in a blaze of white light. The neutrons were affiliative, everybody's friend even back then, enjoying the contact, avoiding the passion, no desperate longing to unite, and they claimed to prefer it that way. But of course it turned out like Mr. and Mrs. Despite their many and obvious differences, they couldn't do without each other. So many new compounds and molecules born to the Adams family not long after. It was a frisky time, full of fizz and sweet confusion. Love ran riot in the spaces between and grew sentient. 13 billion years later, it's still going strong. Years ago, we think, the universe was born in a burst of stupendous energy. Where previously there had only been Tokore, the seedbed of pure potentiality, the quantum vacuum in which neither space nor time exists, there suddenly came a cosmic flaring forth. In the never-to-be-repeated trillion-degree blast, there were vast quantities of some atomic particles shimmering for the briefest instant and then gone, replaced by other shimmering particles, a sextillion of them, cascading, foaming forth as the universe was annihilated and reborn 1,000 times before the first second of time had passed. The wildness and sheer creative power of this original birth is indescribable. All the energy in the universe came into being in this first instant. In 13 billion years, there has not been added one iota of new material. It was all there at the start. Those exact same subatomic particles power the light of the stars and make up the cells of our body. We are made of stardust. What has occurred since, the history of the universe since time began, is a series of energy transformations, a gradual unfolding of inherent possibilities, which were present but unrealized at the beginning, as the universe has expanded and grown, just like any living being. The universe is alive and still growing today as it's done since the beginning. Everything that's happened since is a progressive building up of atomic complexity towards more organized, elegant, interdependent, holistic systems. The cosmic symphony of what we call matter, the 100 elements of the periodic table, gradually evolved over billions of years. The symphony of life, which is not separate but simply a more complex form of matter, has been playing on planet Earth for the last 4 billion years. The symphony of consciousness or self-consciousness or what we call mind or what we call spirituality is more recent still, but again, not separate, simply a more complex form of these elemental parts. And this has all happened naturally, organically, in an orderly progression from the very beginning. This is creation at work, and we arrive in the midst of it as a part of this whole. There's no logical reason to believe that matter and spirit are separate. There's no reason not to believe that the birth of the universe was a spiritual event whose final finished adult form is still unrealized and unknown, and that we are part of this evolution. That we're able to appreciate this awesome creative reality is perhaps our gift to the universe which gave us life. In their seminal book, The Universe Story, written in 1992, Brian Swim and Thomas Berry describe a coherent story of the universe in its historical sequence in measurable time that was never explicitly documented prior to the 20th century. Only recently, indeed only in our lifetime, has the central revelation of 500 years of scientific truth-seeking been made manifest. The gospel of science reveals that the universe is not only a vast, ever-repeating seasonal and celestial cycle, but is also evolving in an identifiable sequence of irreversible transformations. It is dynamic, evolving, a self-organizing system that is constantly becoming more complex and diverse, while at the same time more harmonious, integrated, and sentient, conscious, and self-aware. If the universe is not a mechanism that began with a big bang, but a living being, then what is called God in a religious context is called, in a scientific context, nature. The natural world is the primary revelation of the divine. While science attempts to maintain objectivity or critical distance from what it studies, its subject matter, the universe itself, is not a collection of objects, but a communion of subjects. This recognition, this epiphany, is supported by extensive empirical evidence in every single field of scientific endeavor. The closing of the gap between secular intellect and spiritual awareness is the healing of a split that could turn out to be extremely consequential for the fate and future of humanity. It has the potential to help us understand and heal our world. The implications for psychotherapy are likewise profound. We are in the people-making business, attempting to help our fellow humans grow into themselves, that is, bigger, more spacious, more differentiated, more individuated, more articulate, more complex, dynamic, connected, interdependent, and integrated, just like the universe. The recognition of psychogenesis as a holograph of cosmogenesis is like flying in a tiny plane and suddenly catching an enormous tailwind. It won't make the ride any smoother, but you know you're going to get there a lot quicker. We have God on our side. And now I want to adapt a joke that Michael told us a few days ago. This is a slightly different version. What's the difference between a psychotherapist and God? God doesn't think she's a psychotherapist. So not the Old Testament, look out, I'm coming to kick your ass, God, but the God that holds the really big picture and holds us in the palm of her hand. She says to us approximately what we say to our clients: relax and let yourself expand. It's going to be all right. Psychotherapy works to expand our vision and version of the human person. Psyche means soul. There are no external criteria by which soul can be measured or defined. Soul can only be apprehended from within. The language of soul is elusive rather than conclusive. It is the language of myth and metaphor, signs and symbols, overdetermined, full of multiple significances, an inexhaustible storehouse of potential meanings waiting to be discovered. As practicing psychotherapists, we have learned to appreciate and value the process of making meaning, staying with the questions themselves, trusting the process, tolerating ambiguity, letting go into the mystery of life, waiting to see what emerges next. Psychotherapists work to bring into focus the inner life, the life that is most private and precious to each of us. Psychotherapy values the small, the specific, the tiny gesture, and the intimate nuance. We share this attitude with many others for whom psyche and soul are heritage and treasure: the poet, the lover, the neighbor, and the friend. Psychotherapy understands the world at large from this interior vantage point. From the psychotherapeutic perspective, the human unconscious is constantly at play in the world. It is like the ocean that covers four-fifths of our planet, or the dark matter that makes up four-fifths of our universe. Psychotherapy often turns to the dark matter of dreams, imagination, and fantasy. The timeless appeal of dreams is a landscape of the self in which the ego no longer dominates. In sleep, we relinquish our need for vigilance and self-ownership. The ego all but disappears, and the true diversity of self is revealed. Dreams are the night shift, the workings of our creative imagination, in which there are multiple centers of consciousness, subpersonalities, varieties, and parts of self. Within a single dream, there may be several different experiences of I or no I as such. Dreams lead us back to the original indigenous territory of the self. Dreams have potential to broaden and deepen our self-awareness, bringing to consciousness many aspects or elements of self not included by the ego. The royal road to the unconscious is also a significant source of psychogenesis. What we are is always more than we can know. Understanding the inner world is possible only when we grasp its depth as well as its surface, feel the tidal pull of desire, chart the cross currents of basic needs and feelings. It is these which provide so much of the motive and meaning of our lives. Here we encounter something of a paradox as psychotherapists. In some respects, our discipline is deconstructive. It is skepticism operationalized. We pay close attention to sleights of mind, to the tendency of human beings to deceive themselves, and we explore their motivations for doing so, chief among which are the satisfaction of basic impulses and the protection of self-esteem. But our well-honed capacity to deconstruct surface meanings and surface motives in favor of their underlying deep structures only delivers maximum therapeutic value if it's paired with the capacity to reconstruct all of the developmental and evolutionary potentials that are inherent in these drives to basic satisfactions or need to maintain self-esteem. According to the wisdom of reparative psychotherapy, we human beings grow best when we feel safe, satisfied, and cared for. This growth is visible in the moment as psyche relaxing and opening, the flowering of heart and mind. The marriage of the analytic tradition and the empathic tradition produces a reparative emphasis that bears a striking resemblance to good parenting. Empathy and analysis are a bit like mom and dad. The primary business of psychotherapy then becomes midwifery to the process of psychogenesis, the developmental activation within the client of an inner ideal of psychological maturity that draws or attracts them forward. This ideal is often made palpable first in the transferential idealization of the person of the therapist. Both idealized and devalued, the therapist is held accountable for role modeling what the client senses they might in time become. If over time the ups and downs of the therapy relationship allow this ideal to be protected and preserved while at the same time gradually becoming more realistic, a unique opportunity for personal growth has been created. From this perspective, psychotherapists are not so much providers of the symbolic function in a general sense as it is our specific job, just as a parent might imagine their child's future, to imagine who this client might become if things go well. Reparative psychotherapy is also preparative. It does not merely aim to accept our current condition and appreciate where it comes from, but actively embraces and dances with who we might be on the way to becoming. As practitioners in Aotearoa, we are lineage holders in both empathic and analytic traditions. This allows us to hold both a reparative and a preparative emphasis in our work with clients, something about which we can feel both humble and proud. The psychotherapy relationship is a fragile little vessel. Often our work is suffused with sadness. Not only are we exposed to a great deal of suffering, but we have to carry responsibility for this suffering and for its alleviation to the best of our ability. Yet we seem, for the most part, able to maintain our buoyancy, often swamped, but usually resurgent. Perhaps we are sustained by the hope and belief that we've learned something of what actually makes people happy, or what allows them to be happy. Certainly we've learned something of what impairs and impedes their happiness. We can and should take some comfort and satisfaction in the thought that by helping our clients to be happy, or at least less unhappy, they in turn will make others less unhappy or happier. Epiphany 2, Eco-Catastrophe, or Bad News from the Life World of the Garden Planet. Again, I'll begin with a poem. This one's called Lord of the Flybys. In the all-grown-up edition, Fly Lord schoolboy toys are mostly guns and ammunition. Our British naval rescue mission fails. We're left to contemplate our sad condition. Naval gaze and wait for wisdom to cure a chronic case of adultism. Another sky-high day of blue on Lost Boy Island. Supply chains straining with the load. Wrapped tight enough to suffocate and snuff the local lads. Treasures piling up in the treasure houses, dug from every corner of the earth. Earth Mother bears us all and suffers as we poke and dig at her with sharpened sticks. Kill the beast, cut her throat, spill her blood, do her in. Once upon a time, early in the 21st century, perhaps a billion intelligent people mindlessly pursued the imperatives of their commercially driven industrial civilization. They vaguely knew that human beings were destroying the earth. It was unsettling to think that their consumer economy and middle-class lifestyle were underpinned by a systematic and global effort to loot and plunder the entire planet. But these destructive activities were mostly out of their hands, directed and controlled by large and powerful corporations and government authorities beyond the ability of any one individual to exert much influence. So they gave their tacit consent to mayhem and murder. They allowed a biocidal, geocidal, and genocidal profit motive to hold sway. The trees were cut and the forests cleared, the lungs of the earth hacked away. The rivers were dammed and the streams polluted, the bloodstream of the earth poisoned. Everywhere there was modernization, a dreary monoculture of urban sprawl and factory farming, replacing the intricate interdependence of species and their habitats. The living soil was paved over or treated with chemicals until it died. Unimaginable quantities of topsoil eroded and blown away or washed downstream. The seas became dumping grounds. The fish, once plentiful, became fewer in number and variety. Huge machines were built to cut into the planet's skin, extracting all the ores and precious metals, siphoning up all the oil. The human race burned oil as fast as they could suck it out of the ground. Millions of years of carbon deposits used up in a few decades, a bonfire of greenhouse gases, heat, and toxic smoke. The skies above dirty cities grew thick with smog. The songbirds disappeared. The protective skin of the atmosphere became stretched and thin. The weather became more violent and unpredictable. The polar ice began to melt. The indigenous peoples of the planet were overrun and persecuted to the brink of extinction. The poor were left hungry and homeless. All this was hailed as progress, justified and excused as the unfortunate but necessary side effects of busy, important human activity. The people of the so-called developed world continued to describe this nightmarish progression to themselves and each other as if it were something wonderful and magnificent. It was almost as if they hated the earth, hated the plants and animals, all the other creatures with whom they shared a home, hated their own physical selves, their frail bodies of skin and bone, their vulnerability to accident and illness, their mortality, their earthly existence itself. They seemed hell-bent on suicide at a collective species level, unable to make the most obvious connections between their culture of selfish individualism and the wholesale destruction of the garden planet, the degradation of quality of life for all the generations to come. Then one day they awoke, as if from a trance, and realized, perhaps just in time, the need for a new dream. World dreaming, the Dream of the Earth community, is the cultural imperative of our time, more important than any other form of thinking, feeling, or human activity, is the development of our capacity to dream that the human species belongs to and with the rest of creation. We must dream a new set of conditions for life on Earth and then take action, collective, concerted, committed action, as if our life depended on it, which it does. If we do not dream this outcome powerfully enough, then we will continue on our road to perdition, and our civilization will likely terminate itself within 100 years. And the survivors, our great-grandchildren, will be left with the ruined remnants of a once incalculably beautiful planet, a waste heap of toxic environments where there once flourished a seemingly endless diversity of magnificent, pristine surroundings. Again, the implications of this for psychotherapy are profound. Saving the planet one person at a time will no longer suffice. We simply must extend our work further out into the world than we have been inclined or prone to do. The primary concern of all health professionals, including psychotherapy, must now extend to the health of the planet itself, from which our physical, emotional, intellectual, and spiritual health is necessarily derived. And alongside the ethic of care with which we are so familiar, we will need an ethic of justice with which we are not as familiar. For it turns out that ecological sustainability, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment are interdependent parts of a single whole. Dismantling the domination structures that continue to make our world unsafe and unsustainable requires real work in the real world, but it is no less an act of consciousness raising that can only take place in our minds. From this, we need to change the world now perspective. The problem with psychotherapy is that it holds a vision of individual social change without holding a complementary and accompanying vision of collective social change. In the absence of a clear vision of collective social change, we're left with two equally unsatisfactory alternatives. With unwarranted optimism, we can make the assumption that the social order will change automatically as individuals change. This is based on the misconception that society is merely the sum total of its constituent individuals. What's missed out are the many ways in which a particular social order protects and defends its status quo, notwithstanding the genuine wish of many of its citizens to effect change. Recognizing the inertia of the established social order while continuing to work purely at an individual level leads to the other alternative, the equally unwarranted pessimistic assumption that individual changes cannot and will not affect the social order, and that there is really nothing psychotherapy can do or even should do about this. We can only get on with fixing individuals and leave society to the sociologists. In this case, psychotherapy is propelled by the weight of its own activities towards what we might call a bourgeois accommodation and bystanderism, an empathy failure that is also an ethical failure. If psychotherapy devotes most of its attention to the well-to-do sectors of society and centers exclusively on the personal roots of their problems, it fails to attend to all those who do not have access to its services. That is the majority of people. Certainly it fails to serve almost all of the most marginal and disenfranchised people, those who suffer most and those who are actually most in need of psychotherapeutic assistance. But equally seriously, psychotherapy then fails to attend sufficiently to the social causes and the social context of personal problems, even to those to whom it does offer its services. Social context is converted into some kind of natural phenomenon, as if stress, the absence of support, inequality, and oppression were the natural and normal order of things, business as usual. The individual then has little choice but to seek a merely personal and individual solution to what are surely group and community problems. At this point, psychotherapy really is serving the interests of the established social order, discouraging the development of collective or community solutions and replacing those with private piecemeal solutions that are without political force or consequence. Of course, psychotherapy is not to be singled out or distinguished from other professions in this regard. All the professions can be viewed as helping to reproduce the status quo and serve the vested interest of an established social order. In a positivist frame, whether liberal or conservative, the professions are evaluated in terms of the good they do. Psychotherapy is evaluated and celebrated in terms of its many benefits to the client. The relative merits of one approach are debated against those of another. Testimonials are solicited to validate the soundness of a particular method or set of techniques. If the client is unavailable for comment, as so often seems to be the case, these testimonials can readily be provided by the therapists themselves. Open a psychotherapy journal at random, and one's almost bound to learn just how salutary the effects of therapy can be. What is not evaluated by the professions in this positivist frame is all the good they could have done if only they had attempted it, all the projects that were left untried, all the historical possibilities that dropped by the wayside. Given the needs of the people of Aotearoa, the needs of all the communities at risk, what is it we ought to be doing that we're not? This is a very difficult question, and it is a very different question from the question of what are we doing that is working well. For example, if we were attending more fully to the poor within our communities, how would our conceptual models and practices need to change? What would it mean for psychotherapy to begin to exercise a preferential for the option for the poor instead of for the rich? Perhaps we would learn more from those quite different from ourselves. Those who have been disenfranchised and marginalized often have a clearer understanding of cultural blind spots than those who hold power at the center. In high school, the freshmen knew everybody, while the seniors knew only themselves. The poor understand the rich a great deal better than the rich understand the poor. Māori understand Pākehā better than the reverse, and so on. Consciousness reflects the confines and parameters within which each person is able to reflect on their conditions, situations, and needs. Consciousness requires a context, and that context is the ecological and social niche from which a person acts and has their being. Sociogenesis is no less relevant to psychotherapy than psychogenesis. In our conscious mind, we develop an understanding of ourselves in relation to others and work out our identity, our place in the greater scheme of things. Before it becomes formal thought, consciousness is the unthought known. Through the world and through others, we know ourselves immediately and unreflectively, and we will only ever be able to reflect on this intuitive unity conditionally and in part. Understood in this way, consciousness is an historical psychosocial reality which operates at a collective level. Each individual person only partly appropriates and elaborates this collective understanding as their own mind. The group mind comes first, then the individual mind. Me before I. My consciousness includes an image of myself that's core to my being, and this is a product of my intersubjective history and obviously not a private matter. But my consciousness also includes all the social and everyday knowledge I call common sense. From a psychotherapeutic point of view, the knowledge that counts most is tacit knowledge, not explicit and formalized, but rather implicit and informal, unconscious understanding. This knowledge is both practically and ideologically important as it works or fails to work to help me deal with the world and other people, assists or obstructs me with the task of empowerment, develops or fails to develop my empathy and humanity. These tasks are all part of the effort of people and groups of people to define their identities and determine their fate. A psychotherapy informed by sociogenesis pays particular attention to group history and the group needs of the people with whom it is working. That there are severe ecological and social threats to human health and well-being worldwide does not yet tell us how this manifests specifically in Aotearoa, New Zealand, or how the person sitting in front of us is being personally affected. If we want to diagnose and treat the structural and systemic injustices of our society, we want to know, how is this person or this family or this community actually being affected? We might reflect thoughtfully on the seamless continuity between colonization and globalization, our past nearly two centuries as a far-flung outpost of the British Empire, and our present-day subjugation to the military and economic plutocracy commonly known as the American Empire, most of whose power is now directed by and for the benefit of gigantic transnational corporations. How does accommodation to this reality impinge on the client? In Aotearoa, New Zealand, our economic slavery is all but guaranteed by a set of nearly 3,000 separate, legally binding economic contracts that confirm and consolidate our international disadvantage. In psychotherapy, it is not considered bad form to introduce the client to aspects of the unconscious they may know nothing about, but it is considered bad form to introduce the client to political, economic, and social realities of which they may have been previously unaware. Because this is not our area of expertise, because the client is already an expert in these matters themselves or thinks they are? What is key in each particular instance is the therapist's ability to remain experience near, to describe those things and perhaps only those things that actually help the client to make more sense of their experience. Let me just briefly mention three sociogenetic ills that afflict many clients but are too rarely talked about in psychotherapy. The first is the modern superstition known as scientism, an over-reliance on science and technology as the solution to all our problems. Scientism is an ideology which obscures the foundations of science and technology as specific cultural forms of knowledge. These remain hidden beneath a mask of objectivity, impartiality, and ethical neutrality. Scientism is, among other things, hubris, the unexamined and unwarranted assumption that man is the measure of all things. The practical results of our hubris, amplified and extended through our cleverness, our technological prowess, is that our world of wonder has become a waste world. We now have a disposable planet with throwaway products, throwaway people, throwaway communities, and throwaway nations, failed states. Yet many people continue to blindly believe in the power and glory of science, all the while wondering why they feel spiritually empty, afraid of meaninglessness, and afraid of death. We might say the reason for this is perfectly obvious. To believe in a mental, social, human construction of the universe, instead of believing in the universe itself, is to court the inevitable disappointment and disillusionment of putting our faith in a container too small to hold it. A second threat to mental health is capitalism, and in particular, the triumphant capitalist ideology that supports extremely narrow definitions of the individual self. This is an ideology that sanctions selfishness and idealizes excellence bred from competition instead of cooperation, and it has been allowed to dominate the entire planet. The predictable result is plenty for the few and poverty for the many. Our particular and very accidental form of human civilization pays overt lip service to ideals of equality and justice, but is covertly predicated on inequality and injustice. It's not an exaggeration, but a statement of fact to say that the current social arrangements are oppressive to the majority of human beings on the planet and getting worse. Of course, psychotherapy desires to succeed in the marketplace. Of course, we must find some way to manage within our economic context, within the system as it is, to accommodate the economic realities of competition for customers, supply and demand pricing, and profit-driven practice. Of course, we're to be forgiven our desire to make a living, even to make a good living. But perhaps we should, in all honesty, admit at the same time that the niche market of private practice dear to so many of us has only a very limited potential to effect transformative social change. Perhaps this is why we are so slow to have conversations with clients about their economic oppression of others and by others. A third threat to social and mental health arises from our accommodation to an alliance with the powers of the state, or crown, as I prefer to call it, because whereas state suggests an immortal, faceless bureaucratic authority, a crown signifies the actual historical origins of this authority. Psychotherapists desire to enjoy high status, get or hold on to our share of the pie, keep up with the rival professionals, access public funds, create and occupy our own special occupational class. All of these motivate the quest for state sponsorship and crown-authorized legitimacy. But as we come to learn, neither crown nor state are keen to share their power. They are social organisms whose very nature is to amass and hold power, not delegate, share, or give power away. All of the state's legal, financial, and bureaucratic arrangements are organized in the service of this power-holding task in much the same way as a corporation is a social organism whose basic nature and ultimate purpose is to amass and hold profit, and whose entire set of legal and financial instruments are designed to serve this end. And while state and crown may be funded by the public purse, they primarily exist to serve private interests, specifically the vested interest of an influential and powerful elite minority. Now, this is hardly breaking news, but we are reluctant, even amongst ourselves, let alone with our clients, to have serious conversations about what the psychological effects are of vesting our authority, our autonomy, and our self-determination in the hands of privileged people who are accustomed to taking it, saying thanks very much, and declining to reciprocate. If we are going to feel or behave like frightened children in relation to governmental authority, or, conversely, identify ourselves with the aggressor, does this not deserve self-scrutiny? Does it not deserve our most vigorous and rigorous self-examination? I certainly hope so. Epiphany 3, the last. The arc of psychotherapy, a brief reflection on psychotherapeutic values. A final psychotherapy poem. Many of you know this one. It's called Somewhere a Child is Crying. For God's sake, don't ask me where it hurts. If I knew that, I wouldn't be here. There's a splinter in my mind that makes me wake in the night. Somewhere a child is crying. I dreamt Paris was burning. Fire lit up the night sky, and there were barricades across the boulevards. I knew this revolution was overdue, knew it had to come, but it sickened me just the same. How could blood and bandages be expected to improve anyone's health? Now I'm traveling on foot, alone in a strange city, searching for a lost child, and there's this urgency. Everything is infected with urgency. Don't ask me to hold your hand gently when it's obvious so much is wrong. They've torn down the house I was born in, and all of my family are gone. You ask how I feel? I feel nothing. There's a hole where my heart used to be. But when I hear her cry, I remember my heart. I want to comfort that child and stay by her side. Oh, I could be so loyal. If only I knew how to find her. If only she wasn't so lost to me. This man is searching for his soul. In his dream resides the hope of a spiritual reunion, but he is also well defended against what he most longs for his trauma and his accommodation to his trauma have taken their toll. In the arc of psychotherapy are many small treasures that might help him. Psychotherapy invites the dream and liberates the fantasy. Psychotherapy extends the metaphor and deciphers the symbol. Psychotherapy appreciates the anxiety and deconstructs the defense. It resonates with the feelings, validates the needs, and links the meanings. Psychotherapy co-authors the new narrative by anticipating the emergence of a more complex and diverse sense of self. It helps to birth that self. Psychotherapy is the applied science of the personal world, the art of making and sustaining therapeutic relations, and the vocation of caring for the psyche. Psychotherapy aims at self-understanding and personal growth and offers practical opportunities for second chance learning and second chance growing up. It creates a protected environment within which to think and feel about the most personal matters and develop cognitive and emotional skills that may have been impaired, deleted, or distorted during our early formative years. By creating space and opportunity for a positive attachment to form, psychotherapy offers a corrective emotional relationship that helps to heal emotional pain, the invisible wounds that we carry deep inside us, often as a result of our experience as children. Psychotherapists offer their client a safe space in which to explore questions and doubts about the meaning and purpose of life via the nuances of the here and now relationship, the buried and forgotten but still influential history of previous relationships is refracted as through a prism, illuminated and clarified. Pattern recognition, the presence of repeating themes, characteristic ways that clients have of voicing and making meaning of their experience. These are the things that psychotherapists are trained to notice and find significant. What psychotherapists hold most dear is an ethic of care for all those who need it, not just those who deserve it. Healing is valued wherever it's found. We also seek to educate ourselves about those to whom justice has been denied, and to develop an unrestricted ethic of justice that is restorative rather than retaliatory. We claim humanity as our in-group, so we offer our ethic of loyalty to all our fellow human beings, and beyond this to our non-human fellow creatures, such as ducks. While we may judiciously prune our ethic of obedience to authority, we stand ready to respect good authority where we find it. Finally, we expand the ethic of purity to insist that purity is found in the unity of body and soul, thought and feeling, people in their communities, communities in their environments. Psychotherapists value human needs and feelings above power and efficiency. We seek contact and relationship. We strive to listen to all the voices. We seek a unity in which diversity is protected and preserved. We nurture the tender shoot, attend to children and the vulnerable, child parts of the self. We believe in the importance of the past, pay close attention to origins, and study how living things unfold, develop, and grow. We attempt to practice on a daily basis in a very humble way and not always successfully the principles of nonviolence, consensus, dialogue, reciprocity, and respect for difference. Psychotherapy is a contemporary wisdom tradition that believes human beings can live with care and skill in congruence with life-enhancing values, achieve personal satisfaction and happiness, and leave the world a better place than we find it. Psychotherapy helps us begin from where we really are. The adult version of happily ever after cannot offer us a resolution free of conflict or compromise, but it can affirm life and its joyful possibilities. By encouraging us to accept ourselves as we are and understand ourselves in the context of our history, Psychotherapy develops and deepens our awareness and prepares us for the challenge of change. The alleviation of painful symptoms frees our energies for other tasks. This tends to facilitate flexibility and adaptive coping and increases our chances of success in meeting developmental challenges and achieving life goals. Psychotherapists know that happiness and the good life bear strikingly little resemblance to conventional fantasies of success. Self-interest has always made a very poor substitute for self-care. The ubiquitous preoccupations of our age, wealth, power, fame, prestige, glamour, and luxury, are symbolic achievements that fail to deliver the quality of life they promise. If we are to ensure species survival and long-term sustainability, we will have to undertake the difficult process of recovery from our collective addictions to money, power, status, glamour, celebrity, leisure, and comfort. Happiness is not a commodity or lifestyle. It cannot be bought or sold. We can't compete for happiness, win it, grab it, go for it, or achieve it through force of will. Happiness is emotional satisfaction, the byproduct of a life lived with care and skill in accordance with life-enhancing values. Psychotherapy can help us develop a vision of the good life that embodies another set of values: intimacy and interdependence, rest and relaxation, pragmatism, frugality and thrift, enjoyment of good work and being useful, thoughtfulness, contemplation, kindness, empathic attunement, hospitality, generosity, pleasure in the human imagination, reverence for the mystery of the cosmos, humility, gratitude, and grace, to name but a few. We can develop healthy attachments, learn to belong, make contact, connect, engage, relate, include ourselves, and join the dance. We can be vital and free, autonomous and self-determining. We can play, create, develop our spontaneity, humor, sense of fun, and capacity to enjoy the moment. We can be constructive and productive, remake, reshape, and influence our world. We can take the inward journey, learn to know and appreciate ourselves, find satisfaction in making meaning. We can find love, intimacy, ecstasy, and contentment in a shared existence. We can grow our abilities as guardians, protectors, and providers, care for each other faithfully with loyalty and devotion. We can develop spirituality and wisdom, enhance and extend our capacity for gratitude and celebration, integration and wholeness. At full maturity, human beings glimpse, if but for a brief moment, the possibility of partnership with the entire cosmos, the whole of creation, our playground, work site, cathedral, and marriage bed. Psychotherapy holds the hope that if I can change, so can the world. All of these psychotherapeutic principles can be applied to progressively larger levels of social organization, from the individual psyche to the psyche of the world. Individual microculture, family mini culture, local community culture, and global macro culture are four levels and four interdependent domains in which to understand the reciprocal influences that produce a unified field that includes both private and public life. Parents replay the dynamics of their childhood histories each time they come together and create families of their own. But equally, family life is the heart of personal life, without which we would be barely individual, homeless, and bereft. A healthy community is needed to contain and hold the lives of its constituent families, giving them shared identity, meaning, and purpose. A healthy nation is needed to join and unify its communities while protecting their diversity and supporting their local self-determination. Where psychotherapy can extend itself towards our century, the 21st century, will be to integrate its understanding of persons and personal history with a wide appreciation of all the other species of life besides the human and a deep appreciation for the natural world as the primary ground and context of all human life. An intrapsychic and interpersonal orientation takes its proper place alongside a systemic social and eco-spiritual orientation. If the first century of psychotherapy was governed by a particle theory of the self in which each person had a unique individual space-time address, the second century of psychotherapy will be governed by a wave theory of the self in which we can be understood as the sum of our relationships, social, cultural, ecological, and spiritual subject relations. Whereas relationships have always made up the background of individual consciousness, now we can think about relationships as the very fabric of the self, the threads from which the individual is woven. Previously, our therapeutic focus had been the development of an independent, autonomous ego. Now, interdependence takes center stage. The breadth as well as the depth of the self is found in the relational matrix in which the microculture of the self is formed and deformed, nurtured and ruptured. The analysis of the ego is complemented and completed by the analysis of the we-go. As the urgency of the need for healing at a global level becomes more and more apparent, we will need to find ways to recognize and develop our we-gos, our group identity, founding these on an ethos of consensus and decentralized local cooperative self-determination. To quote Marshall Rosenberg, founder of NVC, Nonviolent Communication, "Great religious leaders and teachers have always suggested that the new creation, the kingdom of God, is within us. Self-development is where positive change begins. But this should not be confused with being nice or neat or calm or clean. Passive, private spirituality is part of the problem. It perpetuates the status quo and leaves unaltered an unjust and unsustainable civilization. Active communal spirituality, by contrast, is part of the solution. It serves life by actively working to create life-enriching systems. It is, to be sure, a daunting task to get the word out about an alternate indigenous consciousness of human place and purpose, humanize oppressive social structures, relieve some of the suffering they are causing, and teach our children how to inhabit a new earth. Because there is so much to do, we have to invest ourselves with great care and skill. But we can celebrate and enjoy living our new story within existing domination structures while working for all the changes we know are so very needed. Consensus is hard work, sometimes too hard. The critical task of building communities of understanding breaks down or cannot proceed successfully when people are talking past each other, as frequently occurs when unconscious needs and wants become paramount. And we psychotherapists have repeatedly shown ourselves as a group to be no more skillful at building communities than any other human group. Nevertheless, we are obliged to keep trying. For there is only one world, and we all share it. The unity of humanity can and must be lived rather than merely represented. If we do not perish first, our species will grow up. If only in the nick of time, we will learn how to drive and manage the resulting strife without violence and without constantly submitting to relationships based on power imbalance, exploitation, and threat. Dreaming and imagining our essential unity with the whole of creation will help us to hold this hope and work towards this outcome. Psychotherapy begins in the consulting room, but like a stone dropped into a pool of water, it moves outward in ever-widening concentric circles. By developing a public practice to complement its private practice, psychotherapy demonstrates pragmatic possibilities of genuine engagement with the world. These action steps are available to us at every level of culture, self, family, community, and planet. Our vision and our values are grounded in our clinical practice, but on this foundation, we might begin to claim another larger vision. And in this aspiration, we will connect and join with many others.
norera tenakoto, tenakoto, tenara tatokato.
Jonathan, I really appreciated your talk, and I was particularly struck by the idea of bringing into our practice the idea of talking about science, capitalism, and the crown. You talked about it being necessary to approach that from an experience near perspective, and I wondered if you could talk about that a little more. It's certainly something I struggle with in my practice, not to bring that in when it isn't appropriate, but to bring it in when it is appropriate. Would you like to comment?
Well, I suppose I'd love to see us talking about those things. I talk big, but I don't have any answers. It is a question of exploring the questions themselves. It is a question of having those conversations, which currently we don't for the most part. We may have little conversations on the margins, and we are, beginning to form groups in which those questions assume a more legitimate and central place. But we need to engage in a lot of talk before we get skillful with it. I'm not saying, don't talk to clients, but it's tricky, as we know. It's tricky to introduce, new stuff, even if it's directly relevant. And I suppose the first thing is to conscientize ourselves. What place do all these things have in our lives? We don't generally discuss that, do we?
It's really interesting. As soon as you say that, it makes me realize, or it made me realize that if I start to talk about those things, I feel like I'm taking a concrete position and not staying in a not knowing. And that seems to conflict with my rather naive idea of myself as a psychotherapist. But it's actually really helpful to even have made that realization in myself.
Well, we should maintain an attitude of skepticism towards ourselves in this regard. We throw words around like concrete or fundamentalist or splitting, and that's sort of like doo-doo, caca, pee-pee for grown-ups. We ought to demystify our own language a little bit around this stuff and go, whoa, that was a stop sign. So I'm not supposed to go down that road. Is that what you're saying? I thought we were into free association.
Thanks, Jonathan. I'm just curious, what I heard in your plea was, and maybe this is my bias as psychotherapist, to be more politically active. And I'm just curious what you think about how we can both engage in respectful dialogue, use the skills of psychotherapy, at the same time as some of the institutions we need to engage with are fundamentally abusive and non-dialogue.
Like ACC,
for instance.
I don't need us to succeed. I just want us to try.
Jonathan, thank you. What came to me as you were talking, I felt a challenge being thrown out. And I went into a kind of fear place and thinking, it's pretty tough for me surviving right now as a psychotherapist with the bottom cut out of ACC. And, you're saying be generous and, open it up. And what came to me as I was sitting there, I was thinking, yeah, there's several psychotherapists who live in my area. Maybe we could get together and, open a kind of place where people could come, and maybe we could kind of share that. I mean, that's just the process that I went through in the last, during your talk. So thank you for that. I feel really touched. take on some
Thank
sort
you.
Of challenge.
Thank you for your talk. Jacob Moreno said that in every group work session, aim at no less than world peace. And as a group psychotherapist, being my main love, not just psychodrama, but conversational group psychotherapy, it does seem to be there is more emphasis on individual psychotherapy, I think, in NZAP and also in NZAC. And I think that group work is a very powerful way of building communities, which I love.
Well, I've been part of this community for a long time, and I know your hearts are in the right place. I don't doubt that for a minute. The potential is enormous, and in saying that, I in no way wish to diminish what we actually achieve and accomplish on a daily basis. You all do wonderful work. There's no question about it. So in kind of raising the bar, it's really about the external situation that we face. These are desperate times. We really are, on the eve of destruction. And I don't think that's terribly contestable anymore. So that's it. It is somehow to how we can respond to that challenge. I'm certainly not wanting to undercut anybody's ability to make a living or make a life. I want us to be happy individuals, but collectively, we have skills and we have consciousness, and I just want to see us use them.
Jonathan, I loved your talk. Thank you. I come from a history as a feminist, as a communist, and also as a Quaker. You can be all three. And what the words of yours that stick in my mind are public practice. And I take those words and I think of Susan Hawthorne. I think of the work that was done publicly on behalf of sexual abuse survivors. And when, if we as a body, and I can say we now because I'm now a member, that we as a body can speak loudly and publicly for justice and equality, integrity and peace, then we are using our understanding of the collective unconscious in order to speak to it. And I really welcome those words, and I really hope there is a really gritty dialogue about those issues. So thank you.
At this point, I want us to give Jonathan an enormous round of applause.